Okay, we now have Ramesh Johri from Management Science and Engineering talking to us about reputation systems.
Right, so I decided actually the best way to approach this, first of all, I should tell you what my perspective is here. I'm part of a group in MS&E that's been leading me for about 3 years now on reputation systems. And reputation systems to us is pretty broadly interpreted. I'll describe a little bit of what the high-level perspective is on that as I go through the talk. And our main interest was sort of, it's important to emphasize that it was academic, and what that means is that we were interested in understanding. So, as you're going to see as I talk, there's a fundamental sort of impossibility that underlies the goal of reputation and recommendation systems. And so that inherently makes the problem interesting. You know that reputation is somehow a fundamental quantity in these online environments, and yet somehow you're struggling against something that seems like an insurmountable obstacle. So that's the academic question. How do you actually get through that obstacle? It's nice, of course, because it's also a practically relevant question. You actually need to design these systems. My goal was to, through the kind of interesting speakers and topics that you're covering in this class, and I thought that you're probably going to get a lot of practical insight, and so what I wanted to offer a bit of conceptual thinking so that you can put some structure around the stuff that you learn. And I should also emphasize that nothing that I say is set, so I encourage objections and discussion as much as you can raise. So I'm going to basically offer five thoughts that I have on reputations. The first thing I'm going to talk about is that it's important to distinguish between different types of reputation. Exactly what we mean by reputation inside a specific is not necessarily uniquely determined. The second thing is that it's useful to think often as, of reputation as a sufficient statistic, and I'll explain what that. The third thing is that reputation systems are often plagued by what's called cheap pseudonyms, which is essentially the possibility of creating a new identity. And so inherently, for a successful reputation system, you have to have the ability to control cheap pseudonyms. I want to take between recommendation and reputation, and I'll do that. I guess the high-level bit there is that recommendation systems, the objects that are being recommended are not also the raters. But in reputation systems, the objects that are being rated also do rating. And this creates an incentive problem that a priori doesn't necessarily have to exist in the recommendation system. And then the last thing is, I'll close with what I said is the ability result, Arrow's impossibility theorem, which is really that underneath reputation and recommendation systems is a common theme of preference aggregation. And there are kind of fundamental incompatibilities in aggregating preferences that you have to deal with when you go through this process. So inherently, any method of aggregation is subject to doubt, but I'll talk about what those are. Okay, so let's start with types. I guess it took a while for me to get this distinguishing characteristic. I'm not, still not actually, I have to say, completely convinced this is the right high-level division, but I do think it's a good place to. One thing I was wondering is, what does a reputation really measure? And in the economics literature especially, there's this, they distinguish between things like reputation and trust and enforcement, good behavior. What are these different quantities? Are they measured on the same plane? Are they different concepts? I've actually converged the idea that, that at least it's useful, again, at a high level, to distinguish between reputation that measures the intrinsic quality of an individual, reputation that measures kind of good behavior in or out of a system. So it's useful maybe to put some examples around this. By intrinsic quality, it means that you have a seller on eBay, let's say, who consistently has high value items for sale. So this might be, by high value, I certainly mean high dollar value. What I mean is that you might be interested in watches, and this is an eBay seller who's very, very good at identifying what watches are valuable. Rather than instead of you having to look at such sort of 5,000 word posting, you can actually trust that since the seller is posting it, you know from let's say the seller, past interactions or other people's past interactions, that this is a seller who really knows his stuff, and if you buy something, it's something really, 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 really good, really, really authentic. Similarly, actually. It's worth understanding that this is not to eBay. It's actually, I think, pertinent for almost any online interaction. A content on LinkedIn might be someone who's got high intrinsic quality. They're connected to many influential individuals, or actually, even more simply, if they're influential themselves. Right? So intrinsic quality here is that something out of band from the online system that makes this person important or useful. And one of the problems with online interactions is that you don't have that sort of out-of-band information available to you. You can think of intrinsic quality as sort of the equivalent of an academic transcript. It's an intrinsic feature or features of the individual that makes them valuable to you before you actually sit down and interact with them. Now, we should distinguish that from the actions that are taken by such individuals. Okay, so good here refers not to the intrinsic quality, but rather to the behavior or actions that are taken by this individual when you're interacting with them. Now, you know, what this means is, and it's easy to see why quality and behavior are two different things, right? Because you can have a seller who's very good at identifying good items, but nevertheless, maybe doesn't truthfully advertise. Right? Maybe he builds a good reputation and then uses it, exploits that we advertise. Similarly, you know, and I'm sure that many of you have experiences like this, but it's easy to meet influential people. So then it's easy to identify, you know, intrinsic quality. The question is, are these intrinsic people those that are going to exhibit behavior that's sort of useful for you, right? For example, on LinkedIn, you know, if you use the introductions feature, then what that means is the introduction has to be forwarded through someone you're connected to. The question is that person going to faithfully forward that introduction for you? So you may know this person, if they do forward the introduction, is, you know, has high quality. The question is, if it the behavior that that connection you have with them suggests they should. Actually, in peer-to-peer systems, again, it's even more sort of obvious description of the difference. So intrinsic quality in a peer-to-peer system might be that, you know, a node has a collection of really valued content, you know, lots of movies, let's say, that people want, something like that. But good behavior is this person just free writing, or are they actually, you know, making content available for upload? Right? There's one last example that I have on here that's sort of different from which is that an eBay buyer faithfully reports transaction experience. Okay, now why is that different? It's different because often you care about behavior that doesn't directly concern the reputation system. And some care about behavior that directly concerns the reputation system. Okay. So if you take sort of the two slides together, there's, I think, three classic things you might want reputation for. One is the reputation that defines sort of the intrinsic quality of an individual. Right? So I think before the days when PageRank was subject to extensive spamming, you can think of PageRank as trying to evaluate the intrinsic quality of, say, web pages, right? But PageRank then became subject to sort of secondary effects, which came from bad behavior. And so the next thing that they had to control was, you know, how does the reputation system prevent bad behavior from undermining it? In the examples that I'm giving here, we have different examples of two different classes of what behavior might you might want reputation for. One is behavior inside the reputation system, and the other is behavior outside the reputation system, which means, you know, that the first example there, the seller advertising his goods, that's an action that he takes that's sort of outside the feedback mechanism that eBay operates. You use the feedback mechanism to record them, but it's outside the feedback mechanism that eBay operates. The interesting thing about the third one is that couples behavior inside the reputation to the design of the system itself. And it's something that we don't often think about. We often think about the reputation system as kind of sitting, you know, outside the behavior that agents actually take. But if you look on eBay, you'll often see that there's, you know, back and forth ratings that take place because, let's say, then accuse a buyer of an unfaithful reporting of a transaction, or vice versa. Right? And I think that in reputation systems, distinguish them from recommendation systems, the fact that raters are rating each other is one of the most fundamental problems that's very difficult to overcome. How do you make sure that the behavior of the raters is good inside the system itself before you even get to rating intrinsic quality or behavior outside the system? If you can't fix that, then you have no hope of solving, you know, of developing reputation of work outside of the system. That's like, that's sort of where it needs to be dealt with. I will say that overall, I think eBay's done a good job with this. I mean, experimental evidence that's been collected in a variety of papers suggests that at least there's a, you know, there seems to be a reasonable sort of level of honesty in the reporting. It's one of the ways they measure that is by looking at what the impact is of negative ratings, how often is there, you know, sort of the buildup of a reputation and then exploiting the reputation. And because there's such a high penalty to a negative rating on eBay, it was found actually that one negative rating can cause approximately an 8% revenue. Let's say your first negative rating can cause an 8% drop in revenue. There's sort of a huge incentive not to exhibit bad behavior. So I guess the reputation system there seems to be working. I'm just not sure that, you know, as we look ahead to introduction into systems like LinkedIn or other social networking systems, or into peer-to-peer systems, these are systems where you don't have the luxury of being able to distinguish a buyer and a seller, for example, then, you know, how do you make sure that the kind of bad behavior inside the reputation system that I'm talking about can be prevented? It's an important problem, I guess, that sort of continues to be, I think, both in a topic of intense academic interest, but also practical. I just want to make this point so that you have some...
Let's link this into a couple of things which we have said before. First of all, what is the purpose of a recommendation system?
Reputation system.
For me, recommendation and reputation are totally different things. Recommender system for me is confused that you sort of say, you know, this is the type of it or something.
Well,
recommendations for me
later,
is
yeah.
You can recommend products, you can recommend brands, stuff like this. So let's use that term recommender system for ads and for products, stuff mm-hmm. like this. For reputation, there's still a number of things. There's reputation, there is trust, and that there is expertise. So expertise we define as a property node. Mm-hmm. Trust we define as a property of between two nodes. Mm-hmm. So I might and a metric property. Mm-hmm. You might trust me, I might not at all trust you. Mm-hmm. So can you put reputation in some way relationship to trust mm-hmm. between two people and expertise, mm-hmm. a typically high dimensional property of a node?
Yeah, definitely. So I mean, in terms of what I'm talking about here, I think of intrinsic quality as expertise in terms of suggested. Trust, I think, is something which, I think that the value, I'm going to sort of get to the second interpretation in a second, which is the value of reputation as a sufficient statistic. What that suggests is that in order for a node to trust one hasn't interacted with extensively, he has to use past interactions of this other node to sort of make a decision. And that's where the aspect of reputation comes in. So I think, you know, sort of loosely speaking, I think that expertise definitely is very close to quality, and trust, I think, has more to do with this sort of behavioral aspect of reputation. Ultimately, I mean, trust has, I think, everything to do with, do you expect this node that you're interacting with to execute on sort of the intrinsic quality or expertise that you believe they possess? And that is exactly where, that's exactly sort of the behavioral evaluation that the reputation system needs to take. Needs to be able to do. By the way, anybody knows this, I guess in this class, I'm sure that many people are already aware of this, but eBay is launching a new recommendation system. And does anybody know anything about that recommendation system? Yeah, you want to tell us a little bit about it?
I think it's providing more various ways of feedback. So before you can say positive, negative, or neutral, mm-hmm. leave a comment, but now you can say the item was advertised well, 1 to 5, and they have like 4 other things mm-hmm. that they can ask specifically to get more information about the buying experience.
That's right. So we'll come back to this in a second, actually. Okay.
Do you also have a comment on that?
I think probably you're going to cover the fact that there is no single good behavior, but there are like different types of behavior, and every recommendation for behavior changes.
Yeah.
And the eBay system that we're introducing sort of is byproduct of that sort of understanding.
That there's different behaviors you want to rate, that's what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so I do want to mention this, actually. This is more sort of terminology clarification than anything else. It's useful to mention because of the extensive economic literature on these topics. So, as I said, you can think of reputation as a way to measure, you know, I put it loosely, economists would call this asymmetric information. That is, you know, the person whose reputation you're sort of looking at is someone they know a lot about, and you're using reputation as a proxy for that information which you don't have about them. That's both information about their expertise or their quality, as well as about the behavior, their behavior in the past. And economists distinguish between two kinds of, you know, asymmetric information that there may be in the system. One is literally hidden information, which translates to what I called intrinsic quality. This, by hidden information, what I mean is that there's sort of hidden intrinsic expertise of the node, of the individual, that's not visible to you when you're interacting with them. And in economics, the study of such problems is called adverse selection. And adverse selection is basically that if you know something that someone else doesn't know, it gives you an informational advantage against them that you often want to exploit to be able to, you know, take advantage of the situation. In the advertising setting, of course, this means being able to advertise a low-quality good at slightly higher quality if you know something about it that someone else knows. Actually, other examples of adverse selection, of course, are you know, that... if you sort of have a high value airline ticket, if you're someone who would be willing to pay first class prices, nevertheless, you might want to game the system to be able to get into first class without actually paying that fare, right? You'll pay as little as possible to do that. Now, that behavior on your part isn't necessarily bad, but it's linked to what an economist would call your intrinsic quality. Your intrinsic quality in that situation is how much do you value the airline ticket? Okay, so I guess reason that is that I've been talking about quality in terms of sellers, in terms of, you know, do they have expertise, are they capable of evaluating items or acquiring good items. I think it's also important to understand that there's intrinsic quality of buyers, which is sort of the valuation that they have for objects that they're buying. Okay. Economists then, the other sort of broad class of such problems of asymmetric information deal with what's called moral hazard. This is something that I think we've probably all heard about in routine use and daily use. This is where you're worried about hidden actions instead of hidden information. Again, hidden actions is much clearer that there you're worried about evaluating whether it's behavior or not. Typically where this shows up is in what's called the principal agent problem. So, you have a firm, there's a manager, a decision that needs to be taken, but he's not really an expert in the area, so he hires somebody to help him make the right decision. If he forms a contract with this guy where it's dependent on the decision that's taken, then that sort of creates an incentive problem where the agent may want to take the decision that's in his own best interest rather than the firm. And so the question is, you know, since the manager doesn't actually know which action is the best one, that's moral hazard. Because the agent then has an incentive to sort of, you know, pervert the system without the manager being able to tell. Similarly, in reputations, you know, or in systems that use reputation, as we've already talked about, there's issues of behavior that's often not observable until it's too late. So that's, again, you know, advertising or, as we said, behavior of a buyer, let's say, not reporting truthfully. Okay, so that's just so that you can, you know, parse through the literature if you choose to do so. All right, so this is something that we've kind of touched on a little bit already, and I think is kind of a useful point to make. In terms of, you know, statistical language, the right way I think to think about reputation systems is they're really just a sufficient statistic of the past, or they offer a statistic of the past. Any reputation system is kind of an information compression device. You're using all the past interactions that have happened, importing them into the system, and compressing the data and making it available to the user. Okay? Now, the act of compressing data then, creating a sufficient statistic for the user from all that past interaction. The question is it really sufficient? Okay, so I'm using sufficient here. Typically, a statistician will use the word sufficient statistic to mean that it really is sufficient in the sense that it captures all the information you need from the past relevant decision now. But for reputation systems, it's not so clear cut. I think it's not obvious how much information you should have in the reputation of an individual. And this gets back to what we just talked about. When you're rating sellers on eBay, one obvious thing that of course you can tell on eBay is if number of observations was not part of the reputation, then the reputation system will be pretty useless, right? So suppose the reputation system just maintains the average of like past feedback scores, but it doesn't actually tell you how many scores there were. Well, then you have no sort of confidence in a score. There's no way to tell whether someone who has a high, you know, is actually as good as they claim they are because you don't have enough. You don't know how many interactions there were to tell. So that's sort of an obvious. But the reason I mentioned that is that the flip side of that is, if we conclude that then number of observations should be part of the reputation system, as the system grows, as time goes on, there's more and more observations. Typically, in a Bayesian model, you'll see convergence reputation. Now, if the reputation converges, it means that the next feedback that the seller gets, say, is not actually going to have a dramatic effect on his reputation. So as reputation moves towards this kind of stable limit where it's not around much with individual feedback, it creates an incentive for the seller to cheat. Because one or two or three negative feedbacks is not really going to affect you when you have an infinite horizon of reputation behind you. That's really important to understand because what it suggests is you do want number of observations in the reputation, but maybe you want some kind of exponential weighting, or maybe you want a moving window so that actually not all past behavior is observable. I say that sort of as a conclusion. I think it's important to understand that the typical expectation of a reputation system is, why wouldn't you just show everything? Why would there be any loss by just revealing everything to the buyer? And at least, you know, from sort of a formal modeling standpoint, one of the conclusions is one of the reasons not to reveal everything to the buyer is because the uncertainty of the buyer is one of the things that might make the seller want to sustain a good. Okay? But as soon as the feedback system stabilizes, there's no particular reason for the seller to care about his reputation anymore, and the system then sort of isn't functioning. So I think it's an interesting observation. There's a few papers in the literature that actually have drawn the conclusion that you of course need the number of observations, but maybe you have a wide window to be able to sustain reputation indefinitely, to at least sustain the effect of reputation.
Actually, let me understand that. So is the reason basically sort of that the cost of the buyer of evaluating the raw data is not taken into account if you say, hey, we all transparency, you can see every of the thousand students I've had, whatever they, however they evaluated me in the past. Is that the element of forming?
No, actually, if there were that cost, I think that would be a good thing.
So then explain it again.
In economics, the kind of talk about here is something established by Kurt Smiloff and Samuelson in a 2004 paper. And what they were saying is that, I'm going to sort of parse it down in a much simpler description. The basic idea is that, you know, suppose you have fully rational buyers that could understand everything about the past history of transactions. Well, what they show is that then the beliefs of the buyers of what kind of seller they're facing will have to eventually approach a limit as it goes on forever. Right? The more observations they have, the more and more confident they become about what kind of seller they're dealing with. Now, as that happens, as that stabilizes, the seller also realizes that any one transaction has an increasingly diminishing effect on his reputation. So initially, the seller will care about building a good reputation. Eventually, he realizes, after many, many observations, that the additional transaction is having an infinitesimal effect on his reputation. So then he'll start to develop an incentive to cheat a little bit.
But if we say we really want transparency, I leave it up to the buyer to come up with his model, how much he wants to weigh the current trend. So maybe if the buyer says, I don't care what the dude did, you know, 5 years ago, I care what he did 5 days ago,
Then
that's up to the buyer. So I think if you assume, you make the assumption that we do not know about the time ordering of the transactions, is that right?
So in what I just said, I was assuming to know everything about the past, but I think you're right. So one of the things I'm saying is that one of the assumptions that's implicit in what I just stated is that take into account all information that they can about the past and trust it equally about the seller that they're facing.
Well, that's a strong assumption.
That's an assumption. So I think that in what you're, another way to translate what you're saying is that from my perspective, in the modeling of the reputation system, no matter what level this happens at, whether it happens intrinsically to the buyer or whether the system is doing it, somebody has to constrain the amount of information that's being used in evaluating it. That is, the recent transactions have to matter. That's the point. That's the key point.
Okay, but that is very different from, you know, what I've been preaching here, that data and transparency are, a big difference. So we want the buyer or the model of reputation to be free as far as data from the power, exponential downweight stuff from the far past.
Yeah.
But only if you make assumptions how the algorithm works, such as that each data point is weighed evenly. Only if you do this can you show stuff that throwing away information in the past is simplifying that and keeping everything.
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, actually. Generally speaking, I would say, that mechanism design, where you have sort of self-interested agents interacting, always works better if you put decisions in the hands of the people who have the right information. So that's in favor of the transparency that you're talking about. I guess the only user interface issue that this raises then is that I think most people, for example, parse through, say, 5,000 ratings on eBay to find out what happened. Actually, I don't know whether the shift to the new reputation system, actually, maybe you can tell me, but the shift to the new reputation system is going to include sort of the ability to immediately see all the negative ratings, which has traditionally been something hard to do. But does anybody know if that's true? As far as I know, that's not true. Like, I think, yeah, that's right. So that's one of the main issues, for example, is that if you hire, and there's been surveys like this done, of the last 5,000 ratings, what do you think are the most important? Of course, every buyer puts a huge weight on the negative ratings. That's what they really is, what the negative ratings were. And so, there's a difficulty in search there to find the right information. So transparency, the question is then, user interface implicitly imposes some kind of compression on that transparency. And for a large majority of buyers, the first statistic that they see is the one that's going to determine kind of what their initial reaction is to the seller's quality. Oftentimes, actually, buyers don't even click through to the page where you can see everything about the seller. Just look at what's on the auction listing. So, in that setting, we have to ask the question then, well, what is the right information to include there? And I guess it's partly that frame that I'm responding to. Okay, but back to this other issue about eBay's new reputation system. I think it's important to discuss, as someone mentioned, that there are very, very different even behavioral aspects that would need to be taken into account. Sort of mixing between behavior and quality, but let's take a look through. So one of the reasons that buyers care so much about negative ratings is because they want to know why negative ratings. Oftentimes, a negative rating was left because, let's say, shipping didn't work out. Okay, and if shipping didn't work out, that's one thing. A buyer can sort of argue for strict shipping guarantees from the seller. I think what buyers are really nervous about is when they got the item and it was just completely sort of fraudulent, what the advertisement was. I mean, most buyers would say that's a much worse outcome than sort of an incidental shipping issue. Another interesting thing is that eBay doesn't really tell you much about the value of past transactions, but this is obviously important. You can build a high reputation on a lot of cheap items, right? And that's worth the same as if you'd sold a lot of expensive items. So if you build a high reputation by selling a lot of, then sell something expensive, it's very hard for the buyer to know what the value of past transactions is, right? So that's information that's not contained in the current reputation. The other interesting thing, and I think this is something that's going to change now in the new system, is that it's possible to tell when the reputation of a buyer or as a seller. And that's, again, important because it was observed that many, many sellers would acquire a high reputation by buying items for easier to get good feedback and then turn around and start selling things using the reputation. And then, of course, you know, the new system has this distinguishing four aspects of the transaction experience. Again, that's the goal there is to distinguish between different behaviors so that the user of the reputation can tell exactly what contributed to a good or bad reputation. I think that this is... You know, surprisingly, and I think Andreas hinted at this, academics pay way too much attention to the formal models of this stuff and far too little attention to the user interface problems. I really think that like 90% of the use of our system is driven by the user interface. So, you know, if you're thinking about actually doing this kind of stuff, I would say that probably the primary thing to pay attention to is you should just assume a buyer is going to react to the first thing they see on the page. So the question is, what's the first thing you put on the page? I mean, there's an exponential decrease in visibility past that.
After the discussion on this point, I mean, basically, each person has their own utility they place on the reducing the reduction, how much time they want to put in to review the data.
Exactly.
While in all cases, more data, more transparency is better, not everyone will want to take advantage of it, either because of their own personal utility function or because of UI constraints themselves.
Yeah.
And so the point is, how can you convey the most value of a reputation mechanism that kind of, like, gives people efficient points where they can just look up, cool, I believe that, whether it's, you know, if you said, hey, if we don't use a moving window versus if we do, most people's utility will be higher.
That's right.
But there may be people that still want to go and be like Andreas, so it doesn't mean you can also provide multiple options.
And that's actually what eBay really does. It's what eBay does, exactly. In fact, one interesting thing that came up in a conversation I had with someone the other day is that there may be a transactional value to eBay to limiting the ability to search for negative information. I mean, that was the question you were asking. Why make it hard? If everybody wants to know questions are negative, why make it so hard? And so the example that this person gave me is Richard Zeithauser, who's a professor at Harvard's Policy School. And so Richard was saying that in schools, it's often been found, so let's say in private schools, for example, it's been found that if you reprimand students, it's important not to make a public scene of, you know, what the reprimand was for. So let's say that student gone to school. You know, you may want to release the idea that the student brought a gun to school, but you sort of don't want to, you know, make a public spectacle of it. Now, why is that? Because the more negative information that's propagated, so the more emphasis that's put on negative information, the more sort of subjective interpretation of the scenario becomes that this is kind of a bad, this is generally speaking a bad system. So one of the concerns there was that maybe if you make it easy to search for negative information, that's the first, you know, so if everyone sees there's 5,000 reviews and only 8 negatives, well, that's what I really want to see. You make it really easy to click through and see the 8 negatives. Well, suddenly what everyone looks at then is the negative information. I don't know how many of you use TripAdvisor. This is a rare phenomenon on TripAdvisor. You know, you can. There's some cities where you're never going to be happy with any hotel you pick, because basically any hotel, there's at least 10 bad reviews. You feel like you're going to have cockroaches in your bed if you go stay there. So, you know, I've sort of been amazed at that phenomenon, even personally, psychologically, being aware of it, that the ability to observe negative ratings easily can dramatically shift your perception of how well the system is working. Of course, from eBay's perspective, you want to think that the system is working very well, which then motivates potentially the idea that you don't actually want to make it easy to search for negative information. Yeah?
Actually, not to spend a lot of time, but I 100% disagree with you on that.
Okay, that's actually cool. Yeah, tell me more.
We do this for any specific reason other than the fact that not in your argument, you're thinking that the buyer rating is 100% trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot make that assumption.
Yep.
And so it is important for it to be fair and show a transactional activity of the feedback rating.
Of the feedback, yeah.
So people can make their own judgments.
That's right. Okay, yeah, I'm actually really glad you said that. So
I also actually, I think very highly of Zeithauser. He's one of the you know, really great people. But I have to say that from my experience at Amazon, what you just said is simply incorrect. That people want to know, should I buy this book or should I buy that blender or whatever? And we found that showing them negative review has a higher conversion rate down the road, that they buy something in the session, and impact on them long time, than what many people always, you know, accused Amazon of. Oh, you're suppressing all these negative reviews. So for instance, at Amazon, 60% of all reviews are 5-star reviews.
Mm-hmm.
20% are 4-star reviews. So 80% are 5 or 4 stars. And the rest is more or less uniform, 3, 2, and 1 star.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just the reviews coming in. And you might argue that this is because people who buy something, they want to have sort of positive feedback, that they want to tell themselves that they did something good, and they want to say, hey, I bought this book and it's a really good book, or the blend or something like this. And if it is no good, then they don't even want to think about it anymore, and they're not going to talk about
it. Okay, good. So this is actually really useful. I mean, that clears up what the design principle is. I guess it was about a behavioral phenomenon that takes place, you know, which may or may not be intended. And this is an interesting point, I think. I point to that, which I'll definitely pass on to him. I mean, my feeling on it is that, I guess, again, this is something that's very difficult to calculate, is what is the subjective impact of a negative or a positive rating? In particular, a better way to put that is, what's the information content to the buyer of a positive rating? And I think that maybe the underlying point of Richard's comment was that when the space becomes skewed, the relative value of, so again, in the 5, 4, 3, 2 star setting, if there's a skew of ratings, the bins, the relative value of any one of those ratings decreases. And that is somehow an effect that often isn't incorporated into evaluating what the reputation score is.
I think part of it that explains both is just each of these systems, whatever numerical scale you create, ends up having some kind of meaning. And so, everyone, 4, maybe 3 is bad, or 5, you know, 3 becomes
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, actually, we'll get to that.
I went through the same thing on TripAdvisor, where I went from first, like, shock with everything as cockroaches, to then going, oh, okay, I can see that, you know, if you have, you know, 20% negative reviews is just the norm.
Just the
norm, thing. And the last point, actually, was, then you find yourself trying to evaluate the rater and going, these just seem really picky. Like,
right.
Kind of, so, like, how much are they like me? What rating, whatever they're rating on, how much is it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Which again very much pushes towards the view that the UI is the important part and the app data, rather than some dude, you know, somewhere finding out over 0.73 in front of this coefficient and 0.47 in front of that.
Yep.
Let me tell you another story. Who of you has the picture at hotornot.com? Okay. One of person. Usually then the next question is, who would think of your best friend? Okay. Who has a picture at hotornot? Oh, the hand will go up. But anyways. So the early days of hotornot, I worked with the guys in Berkeley, and it was a pretty, you know, grim world in terms of how cute people thought, how hot people thought, you know, those not really models were. And it turned out it was, I forgot, something like 3 or something like that on the overall average. So people weren't all that happy because he wants to be 2 or 3. And then we decided we just, you know, shift the bit by having not really the mean which is being computed, but something which is sort of about the mean. And we forgot about it. And then that feedback that people just learned because you're predicting how cute is the next set coming up. So that actually shifted the entire population up, that now I think whatever it is, like 7 or 6 or 8 or something like that, I'm not sure, because it was to be turned off, you would have just moved the entire population. People learned what these numbers are. Just like Dan said, at TripAdvisor, you just normalize things. If there are cockroaches everywhere, and then I take the one which has just cockroaches and no fleas.
Yeah. That's right, exactly. We're going to grease this summer with advice. Okay, so, all right, so enough on sufficiency. So we already talked about this, hiding past transactions. Okay, cheap pseudonyms, I guess this is probably something that many people have heard about before, I would think, which is basically that in online environments, typically, if you're trying to get a lot of participation, then one of the sort of side effects of that is that you make it established identities, you know, easy to register and so on, right? And if it's easy to establish identities, then in environments where you also are making reputation, then there's the potential to exploit high reputation for a short-term gain. Okay, so you know, again, tip plus to this has been that, well, and I'm kind of compressing a bit here. I mean, I'm not putting it as technically precisely as I should be, but the basic idea is that to prevent exploiting, you know, an identity, let's say a well-established identity, just for short-term gain, then you have to make sure that creating a new identity has some kind of a cost, which is often called a friction in these systems. And there's actually two ways to do this that's important to understand that there's a distinction between these two. One is, you have an explicit cost to creating a new identity. Okay, maybe you have to pay something, maybe you have to, you know, go through a complicated verification process to set up a new identity. But actually another important approach to this is that there's an implicit cost if building a reputation takes a long time. An interesting design problem, and it comes back to this normalization issue that we just talked about, but you can think about two sort of fundamental rates in any reputation. One is the rate at which reputation can grow, and the other is the rate at which reputation decreases in the event of a bad event, in the event of, sorry, bad behavior. So what is that tied to? It's tied to, at some level, the averaging mechanism the system uses. I mean, again, you can make all past data available. What I'm talking about here is sort of that high order bit that's shown to the user, which is, you know, how have you averaged past transactions to arrive at kind of the score that you show? And they're interesting design parameters and thought of as such, but one way that they're interesting design parameters is exactly in this setting, that tweaking the rate at which reputation can build is actually something that that has a bearing on how easy it is for someone to set up a new identity. So if you'd like to set up a store, it's possible to maintain reputation even in the absence of actual currency, right? Then one possibility is that you just make it hard for someone outside to build up a reputation quickly. And so one attempt anyway was to apply something into peer-to-peer systems. And I think it's an interesting idea. I guess my concern about it goes to the fact that it seems to be a fundamental sort of timescale or unit in the reputation system. Some reputation systems establish that very, very well, others do not. So I think in peer-to-peer, at least it's difficult sometimes to, if you sort of see, you know, the establishment of reputation between peers, it's difficult sometimes to achieve synchronization of what people's perception of a good reputation is. And for the purposes of something like this, that can cause a serious problem.
Hey, two remarks. One is, how do you measure time? Do you measure time
that's exactly
in transactions? Do you measure time in dollars in eBay? Do you measure time in maybe there's chronological time?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I meant, that the scale is really difficult to have a fundamental scale for. So on eBay, for example, it would not be dollars because dollars are not really something that's waiting in the reputation system. And so the natural thing for eBay, I would say, is, but even that causes a problem because, as we already said, right, you can have, you know, high frequency transactions of low value goods. And so I don't know that this is, so this is an academically interesting idea, I think. I don't know how easy it is to translate this into a practical specification. One way to interpret this is that implicit cost can reduce the explicit cost that you need. So, you know, if you imagine having an explicit barrier to entry, you can lower that barrier a little bit if you believe that there's going to be a difficulty to build a reputation once you get into the system anyway. So that is one way that I think that it may be useful. I think that just trusting the system to be able to maintain this is maybe a bit too much.
I think there, yeah, okay, sorry.
Was the same? Yes.
No.
Okay. No,
there's right. much stuff to say, but.
All right. I just want to digress a bit here, since I taught a class on network neutrality just the last 5 weeks. One thing I think that's interesting about this is that we think about reputation as something that's, you know, application level, basically. Mm-hmm. That the system is, you know, the reputation system is effectively a way of authenticating, right? It's a way of establishing an identity and then being able to associate trusted behavior to that identity and intrinsic quality of that identity. But, you know, one of the big issues, I think, in the debate over the future evolution of the underlying architecture is how much should the underlying network be authenticating its user? And I think it's actually useful for someone, again, working in this space to be aware of these developments, because if network authentication improves, that would be something interesting to take advantage of in the process of building a reputation system. It can ease, for example, the problem of cheap pseudonyms if you have authentication in place from a network. This is particularly useful, I think, in enterprise settings, where it is possible that, you know, that sort of the underlying network security architecture is which induces authentication of the users. If you're, you know, if you sort of need a reputation system inside the enterprise, it might be less. You're just trying to build a reputation system for expertise purposes, to be able to get answers. In that sense, it's actually useful. You can circumvent a lot of the issues of, you know, cheap pseudonyms and bad behavior and so on by being able to use authentication. So that, just in a second, I don't want to dwell on that too much. Okay, so Andreas mentioned this earlier. Reputation systems and recommendation systems are often, I think that's a mistake because of, you know, what I mentioned earlier.
Actually, can you help us how anybody in their right mind would think those two things starting with an R and ending with systems?
So here's one reason why. So I do think that there's a common technical aspect to them that from an algorithmic standpoint is useful to study together. And that has to do with the aggregation of individual ratings into a global statistic. Okay? So in a reputation system, you have many individual transactions that you're putting together the entire database and the principle that's available, but then, you know, how are you presenting that data? The process of aggregation, so that's an algorithmic process. But I really think that's where that's something interesting to think about together, but I think the reason to stop there is that you have the incentive problem in reputation systems that you do not have in recommendation systems. And that's from a behavioral standpoint completely different. Okay, so I think it's useful to think about I'm curious to get your feedback on this one, Andreas, but it's interesting to think about the algorithmic problem together. But I think it's important to distinguish between the objects being rated being the raters themselves and the objects being rated being sort of objects outside the band. Now, I guess I said the boundary is fuzzy because I know that, you know, recommendations on Amazon, you think of the system, but there are, you know, scenarios where author of a book, for example, is someone who wants to participate in the system, and then there's kind of a move towards effectively this kind of reputational bad behavior type of issue inside of the system. But I think by and large those are kind of cases that are on the fringe of a recommendation system. In Netflix, I don't think that there's as much of an issue that, you know, Netflix really deals with a data aggregation problem. Yeah.
One example that comes to mind that where they're clearly coupled with dig, where they're actually recommendation by the person.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But that's okay. So actually, that's an interesting example. I think it does call out the distinction here. In dig, I would differentiate between the recommendation system and the reputation system. They're not the same thing, I think. That's actually a great reason that I wanted to bring this up. So to the extent that we believe, you know, that social networking sites are sort of this long-term phenomenon that's here to stay, that they're, you know, particularly on the meta search, I think that we're going to be using them more and more as recommendations for how to get information that we care about around the net. But that aspect of such a site is an algorithmic process. How does it take the information that it has and the ratings that it's collected and produce a recommendation to a prospective user? Now, that's different from maintaining the reputation of users inside the system itself. You may use reputation statistics to make recommendations, but it is unlikely that the process of making recommendations is what is inducing the incentive problem. The incentive problem is sort of directly coupled wanting to maintain good reputation. But so maybe the way to think about this is, in the examples that we had earlier of good behavior inside the reputation system, behavior outside the reputation system, I would think of making good recommendations as good behavior outside the reputation system. It's not part of the reputation system. So you can actually treat the two things separately. I see you don't.
But in dig, the whole your reputation gets determined by the quality of your recommendation, right?
Right. So again, you can think of in the eBay, a reputation will depend on the quality of the advertisement, but the quality of the advertisement is not an interactive reputation system. Distinguish that from: do you truthfully rate the transaction that you have?
Okay.
And so in the reputation dig, the question is: do viewers truthfully rate the recommendations that they saw? And so it's a thin boundary, and I agree that it is. But the reason I want to distinguish between those two is that the sort of intrinsic reputation system is something that has to deal with incentives. I guess in this example, it's worth noting that, so I think this is the point that you're trying to get at, the structure of the recommendation system, the incentives in the reputation system. But I think that goes without saying, because the system itself is a recommendation system. I mean, that's what dig is for. So similarly, the market of eBay will affect the reputation system of eBay. But I want to distinguish between the incentive management of raters inside the reputation and sort of this, you know, broader problem of identifying high-quality individuals.
Actually, also, I realized something, which is the point. I've done a lot of work in behavioral targeting,
mm-hmm.
and there nobody rates stuff. One distinction is that if you talk about recommender systems, are the sources the recommender systems are built on X ratings, which we get a fraction of percent of implicit things people do anyways. And so my mindset is, as you know from class, when we talked about click data and intention data and attention data, none of this was rating data so far. So my mindset is very much, can we come up with recommendations based on a number of sources?
Mm-hmm.
None of them are the ratings of things, because
right.
people just don't get to a few exceptions.
Right.
And those things were, you know, where do they click, where do they hang out, and stuff like that. Now, something which I don't think I've talked about it yet, and I want to talk about last test, but we ran out of time, is if you go to dating sites, that's very interesting, because while you don't actually rate people, you have, for instance, a list of blocked people. And when I was doing some work at Match.com, we looked at one individual, and that individual, everybody that person had blocked were African-American women. So what conclusion do we draw from that?
Mm-hmm.
So if he consistently blocks African-American women, what conclusion do we draw from that?
He
likes African-American women. Because I wouldn't have bought in the first place looking at them or trying to chat them up. So exactly what you just said, that you know, he might be racist, not in a negative sense, that that's the group he's interested in. It doesn't mean that he doesn't like that people who he puts in the block group, but he actually likes that people who puts in the block group. That's why he's spending his time on them.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's really interesting to see what can we get from those more or less imprints of people.
Yes.
So what's the second level bit beside them all being African American women?
So that's it's actually interesting. I was thinking in this, you know, especially there's this group of people working on this kind of stuff at MSME. There's a range of ways that we're thinking about get data about the behavior of individuals in the system that moves from click-through information, which is essentially implicit, to explicit ratings. I think that, of course, these induce, you know, different levels of inference on the part of the system itself. At some level, though, they're all revealed preference, basically. They're implicit or explicit data, it's all revealed preference. And it's sort of the goal of such a system is, whether recommendation or reputation, is to aggregate that preference. The only thing I wanted to say about reputation system is this intrinsic incentive problem. Okay.
So actually, let me see whether we lost everybody, right? Because it's speciality areas. Do you have questions on that? Do you know why we talked about what we talked about right now? Or do you think this guest talking about it? Can I get some feedback?
I mean, other
what are you not clear about right now? Why do you know why we talked about what we talked about? Anybody can help me?
I think, I mean, basically, people leave the when you're recommending objects, people leave those or write those. And people can have a reputation. I mean, the whole point is reputations pertain to people and recommendations pertain to objects, but people are who leave the recommendations. So it's going to, even though they may be separate, at the end of the day, it's what you said, that those rating statistics may be used in the recommendation system.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be incentive problems with that stuff.
That's one way. The way I would look at it, also, again, thinking about next class, is where we talk about recommender systems solely. So we really focus on that. That for recommender systems, only less than 1% of the people big time worry about behavior targeting or stuff like this worry about rating.
Mm-hmm.
So rating, while there is rating in recommender systems, the huge part of the world, those, what is it, $30 billion which flow into online advertising, or $20 billion a year. I mean, a fraction of that actually has to do with rate. The vast majority is about implicit actions you take by, you know, we show you a picture of that person, what are you clicking on? So I think that really is
I think it's even worth noting, for a successful reputation system, I think it's not going to be reasonable to ask for a lot of explicit action. eBay is a nice exception to this, but I mean, if we're talking about, you know, let's say reputation in something like TripAdvisor, I mean, it's really unlikely that most people that use TripAdvisor have a lot of, like, you know, feedback information. So even TripAdvisor, I think, is a site that would have to build reputation based on implicit action rather than explicit action. I just think that, so maybe this what this is getting at, and I want to come back to this point, because I'm not sure that we've really clarified well what the distinct situations like this. So maybe what we should isolate on is, what does reputation mean in a site whose job it is to provide recommendations? What does reputation mean? So what I would think of there is, the primary goal of reputation should be to identify the quality of the recommendation. So there, the real goal is, you want to identify intrinsic quality, right? And where that goes is when it's possible to game the system to suggest your intrinsic quality is higher than it actually is. So that's the incentive problem in the reputation system. But except for that, if it's possible to make sure that the reputation is a good indicator of quality, then you have a recommendation system that can function well, just as any other, just as a Netflix recommendation system would. Okay, so that's how I would distinguish between the incentive problem of the reputation system and the overall goal of the recommendation system.
So, I mean, I have the last word next year, but what I would be saying then is that for recommendations, actually, let's go back to the distinction I made before, which is it a property of the node or is it a property of the, you know, the two nodes? Is there one slot in the function or two slots in the function to put stuff in? And or in my worldview, for recommender systems, there are very much two slots in the function.
Mm-hmm.
It's Rob, and it's some or some person who we want to recommend to Rob. As opposed to in reputation, well, there's only one slot in there. That's another distinction.
It
could be Rob, or it could be the situation, I don't care. But there are always two slots, as opposed to saying everybody in the world, ladies and gentlemen, should be using chunk paper.
So I think we should be a bit more careful than that, right? So
okay.
Reputation has to do with, first of all, you know, when there's reputation, I think there's personalization. So this issue that a recommendation system involves the object and the person that you're recommending the object to, I guess is in the reputation setting as well, which is that if someone claims to be an expert, are they an expert for me or are they an expert for somebody else? And it depends on what our personal experience. The second thing, though, is that this issue of nodes' intrinsic quality, I agree with you. That's what I think we call expertise. Nevertheless, inside the system, the reason that there's still a bilateral transactional issue is that you don't know if you can trust what a person's, you know, expertise is. So a person may have a high intrinsic quality. The question is, did the reputation system do a good job of bringing that out? So how much do I trust that score? And that'll on both who I am and who they are. So, I mean, you know, what I'm saying there is that I think there's a component of both in each system. The question is, why are you using the reputation system in a recommendation system? And my only point there is that I think you're using it to evaluate that intrinsic quality. Okay. So last thing I wanted to talk about was preference aggregation, and this is something I hinted at. So this is kind of the thing that first got me interested in this area. It's basically the algorithmic process of reporting, right? So it's sort of, you know, what I think of as the user interface problem, which is how do you take individual information, and, you know, we're talking about ratings here, but in light of the recent discussion, could just be implicit data that you've got. What do you report? And a key problem here is the units of measurement. So the question is, what does 4.3 stars mean? If you return a movie to Netflix, then they actually have a predicted rating for you. And they show you their predicted rating, and one goal that they have is they want their predicted rating to be close to what you actually would have rated. Of course, you can only do integer ratings, but you know they'd like it to be as close as possible. And that's an incredible goal. It's more than just saying, did you rank this movie higher or lower than this other movie? They're actually trying to identify the numerical score that you would put on a movie. Right? It's worth noting that when you do these experiments with individuals, these scores aren't even consistent. So, you know, if you have different movies, there may not even be a way to assign numbers to them that's consistent with the rankings that you just created, okay? So they may be trying to solve a problem that already is on score you even got into aggregation. So if we only worry about the rank ordering of individuals, I can throw out that problem, what does 4.3 stars mean? But aggregation is still... So this problem, this is what's called ordinal preference aggregation. When you have just rankings and you don't have numbers associated to them, those are called ordinal preferences. And, you know, I think one thing I want to highlight before we go on to talking about the Arrow Theorem is that preference aggregation is, you know, something that you're sort of, what you're looking for, I guess, personalization in the aggregation, okay? And that's kind of back to this point that we just raised. I think, you know, in any of these kind of functional forms that involve the object, or let's say a hotel or something like that, or in the case of a reputation system, if the question is, you know, is the intrinsic expertise of the seller something that I value? And the question is, how do you personalize that score to the person that you're showing it to? Another way to put this, actually, an interesting twist on what we talked about earlier with the transparency of information. So if different buyers have different utilities for the amount of information available, right, suggest that you actually personalize the interface over time to transform sort of the detail of available in the information to the user. The users that are really interested in fine scale statistics, maybe make that easier to find. And the users that are just interested in broad statistics, you try to find the most broad statistic that you can for them. So that's an important thing to think about here, which is that typically the economic literature on this is worried about global aggregation. You know, one ranking for all, okay? It's kind of the sort of the old you know PageRank model of you know, rank all the web pages and then filter based on keyword or something like that, right? I mean, that's suggesting there's a global ranking that you rank off of, versus the new model of kind of personalized search, personalizing returns based on what your own preferences are. Okay, but even then, you know, it's a collection of information and trying to present a ranking. The problem is that there's easy ways to construct paradoxical situations. I mean, this is one just in economics. So suppose you have three guys who, you know, put preferences on the three objects A, B, and C. One prefers A to B to C, two prefers B to A, and three prefers C to A to B. Then if you just look at any pair, A would get two votes over B, B would get two votes over C, and C would get two votes over A. So the reason is, I mean, it's not really a paradox because you don't have to do majority voting, but the is that if you did do majority voting, then there would be no way to conclude which one should be ranked higher. Now, just out of curiosity, what would you actually do? Suppose you had three people. What would you do to try to come up with a rating?
With ordinal rank?
What's that?
With ordinal rank?
Yeah, so I give you this information. Some interesting case of this is tournaments, right? Things like you know NCAA tournament, basketball tournament, and so on. Right? These are methods, you know, implicit rankings, which is basically the quality of the teams, and turning it into an overall choice of what's the best team. I think a question that we don't often ask is, well, depends who you are, I guess, but maybe isn't asked often enough is, what if you change the structure of the tournament? The outcome be different? The answer is almost always yes. In fact, there's an old theorem in economics that given any individuals and such preferences, and given a particular individual's most preferred choice, there exists a voting process that leads to that choice being implemented. Okay? Does everybody understand that statement? So it basically means that these three guys, you can set up different voting processes that will lead to any one of the three outcomes being implemented. Now, maybe that doesn't sound surprising in light of what I just put up. But I think it is surprising in light of any number of decision-making processes that you've been involved in. And in particular, where it really gets interesting then is how do you, when you get information together, the statistical approach is to sort of identify the fundamental information content of data that you have. But there's this preference base which says that the process by which you aggregate actually matters a lot. Right? And you know, I think this is one of the sort of interesting things is, well, how do you kind of identify that in an online data setting, right? There's a very big gap between economists who talk about preferences and statistics data sets and produce aggregated statistics from them. So it's kind of interesting to think about putting those two ideas together. All right, so some of you may have seen this just to isolate the formal definition. A central result in preference aggregation is Arrow's impossibility theorem, which basically says, under reasonable assumptions, aggregate preferences is a dictatorship. What that means is that the only way to give aggregate preferences that satisfy reasonable conditions is that you just imagine that one guy would have wanted, that you identified in advance. So what are the assumptions? I'll just briefly mention what they are. What Arrow says is that, so he thinks aggregation is a process that takes in the preferences of everybody and produces a decision. Right? So he says that, first of all, this process has to be able to take any preferences of all the individuals. That's universality. It has to be Pareto efficient, which means the decision it produces should be a decision among all the individuals. That means there shouldn't be another decision you could have taken that made everyone else at least as happy and at least one person strictly happier. And the last one is the most controversial one, which is what's called independence of irrelevant alternatives. And that basically says that whether you choose, you know, whether you, the sort of the global social preference puts A over B should only depend on people's relative rankings of A and B, not where they are in the list. And you can see here why that causes a problem. Because we're not taking how far above, you know, the different alternatives A, B, or C are. We're just taking account of whether they're right above the other. And there's no clear way to take a majority rule in this setting because we're not taking advantage of any sort of distance information. It's clear that we really can't because we don't know what units people use. So, you know, you made this comment about the 20% baseline in TripAdvisor is kind of the norm of bad rating call or something. And I find that really, really interesting, which is that again, economists have spent a lot of time sort of arguing that there aren't preferences or fundamental units to preferences except for dollars, basically. If you can get people to use money on something, then you can suddenly compare preferences over different items. Other than that, there's not really a fundamental way to tell whether 4 stars on this hotel means the same as 4 stars on that hotel, whether 4 stars from this individual means 4 stars from that individual. And yet, all that taken into account, we still have kind of these emergent behaviors where 20% emerges that you can compare against. So I think that's a really interesting thing to take into account. That's one of the gaps between the data analysis approach and the economic approach. It's interesting to think about filling in. So the moral of both of these slides is really that the process of aggregation matters. So the process that you go through, that's the moral term as well. Arrow states this is a static problem, but if you think about actually going through a tournament, then the process of aggregation matters. Actually, by the way, it's just worth, just as an aside, there's this really cool article on Slate from a couple of years ago, which is about designing the best series. So the World Series in the U.S., is, you know, baseball is a 7-game series, winner 4 wins, okay? So what Slate asked was, what if you had teams that, you know, you have two different probabilities on the probabilities of winning on the team. The question is, does, you know, the length of the series and the you know, order of winning, so basically at what cup points which team had won, so that you minimize the expected number of games that have to be played to identify the best team. Right? And it's interesting, you know, he tweaks the series so that, for example, if it goes to 3-1, you declare the guy who won 3 games the winner. But if it goes to 2-2, then you end up actually playing 3 more games, right? Just a normal series. So it's an interesting design problem to think of the process, designing the process to achieve kind of the most robust that you can at the end. No, I guess that's it. So I guess, you know, my goal was mainly to convey sort of some conceptual ideas. I think what I enjoyed about this discussion, actually, it reveals both a gap and a closeness in how people think about things. I think the gap is that, and I've identified some of the help and others have come up in discussion about, but I think the gaps come in to the distinction between user interface, data presentation, data collection, and sort of academic treatment of preferences. But there's a lot of sort of interesting insights from school approach that suggest my interest primarily is in identifying how you split the meanings of reputation across a system and actually aggregate and present the right statistic to the user. So when I think about that, for me that comes back to both the preferences of the user and kind of the statistical problem of aggregation. So that's the thing that I think is a lot of fun.
So
anyway.
One actually is really the cost of collecting data.
Mm. That's an interesting point.
When I talk to people, I think one of the key questions, that's why I structured the course that we talked so much about how easy and how cheap it is to collect data for you in the online world, is that most of economics is built on, think about CCI as we know it, built off having few data points. Most economists have a really personal relationship with every data point they collected. Whereas at Amazon.com, where every day you get between 10 million and 100 million data points in, it's difficult to have so many personal relationships. And that is a big way of difference in thinking. And statistics actually is not clearly on the other side. Mm-hmm. So statistics, there are some statisticians who, you know, when we talk about experimental design, 100 years ago, statisticians were really good at figuring out how those rabbits can be used in their breeding behavior. Whereas other statisticians, John Tukey was one of the leaders in that field, Jerry Friedman is one of the great people in that field, speak about, you know, experimental design in the light of it not being super expensive to create data points. That is something which I want to put in your mind, maybe what is the cost of collecting data? Mm-hmm. And that should inform really how you will drive the decisions you will make. Mm-hmm. Another thing which we didn't talk about today, but which is underlying the decision of what you should drive, is what actions are you taking and how do you know that you're doing well, that you're doing poorly? Mm-hmm. So one of the things we didn't talk about, but you should talk about is, if you still have time.
I've got about 2 more minutes.
Okay, is what do we do with those ratings? I mean, how do we people, for instance, trade off the ratings of one store versus another store? This store is more expensive, but it has 5 stars, versus that store is cheaper, it has only 4 stars. You mentioned those 8% of the first negative review. Mm-hmm. And Amazon, we estimated about $50, 20 to 50 bucks, depending on which model you use, is the value of getting a review for a book or mm-hmm. for, you know, a blender, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? You know, what comes after just providing people with a reputation?
Yes,
what do you do with a reputation?
Yeah, I guess I found your response really interesting, actually, about the design process, because, for example, I'll do this sort of as by way of a non sequitur. I've worked a lot on network pricing, and by network pricing, I mean like network congestion. And one of the interests in that field was, at least when it was, this was like maybe 7-8 years ago, was that maybe it would be some network providers to offer sort of microscopic signals on packet level that guide traffic sort of to efficient allocation around the network. So I find your response really interesting because, I mean, ultimately, many of these systems are being run by sort of profit-maximizing entities, but since it's not clear that gaming the reputation system from the point of view of the system, you know, managers is the best way to make profit, since oftentimes the system is really there to enable the other activities that really generate the profit, it often becomes the system manager's goal to act in a socially optimal way. I mean, that's kind of what your response suggested there. I find that interesting, actually. So then the question becomes, what is socially optimal? I think that's what you're getting at. How do you evaluate that the reputation is actually being used in some useful way? So, you know, academics get around this by sort of like, which is, let's say if I cared about quality, I just assumed there was intrinsic quality. And then I could start to prove things about whether, you know, reputation was starting to approach quality. Well, then it would be working well. If it didn't have any correlation to intrinsic quality, then it wouldn't be working well. But I find that that's kind of a, you know, again, academic at best interpretation in terms of practice, because in practice it doesn't help you to really pretend that there is intrinsic quality. You have some, you know, non-parametric way of evaluating that the reputation system is delivering on its promise. I think one way to do that is through measurement of something like regret. So maybe if you're the system manager, you can ask, okay, let me look at the past behavior of my system. I've got a bunch of data, as you said, data collection isn't often very expensive. So I could say, well, if I look at this data, let me pull hypotheticals where, you know, when I had, let's say, run, and again, this is actually the kind of thing which is done quite often, I think, in terms of system experimentation online. If I had, you know, aggregated feedback in this way, and instead tried presenting it feedback in this way, well, I can actually run experiments, because there is sort of times enough data collection capability to compare the possibilities of running a reputation in those two different ways. And in doing so, you have the possibility of comparing, you know, with hindsight, what different schemes would have given you. So, you know, in sort of a, this is what's called online optimization. And so what you try to do then is adjust as you're moving through this kind of uncertain system, adjust your behavior, your decisions, so are moving in the direction of presenting information or taking decisions that are minimizing your regret. So here, you know, I think this is hard for me personally, because the question really hints at what should the system manager be doing. I think the one question is, of course, what do buyers, sellers, you know, raters, users of TripAdvisor, et cetera, do with reputation? But I think the hardest one of those questions of, you know, what do you do with reputation, what now, is what does a manager do next? And that's really hard, because for them, the knobs that they're tweaking are really the UI design knobs and the data aggregation knobs. And that's a place where I think there's so much kind of uncertainty and model uncertainty around you that it's useful maybe to think in terms of regret relative past decisions that you've taken. Any other questions? Right. You can easily find me online, I guess, Andreas, and you can probably link to the page if you want. So
it's on the class wiki.
Oh, okay, good.
Yep.
So thanks.
Okay, so let's thank both speakers. I know you deserve your break, but I have to do two things before break. Bill just bugged me and said, you know, he's listening in the thing. He says, you didn't ask who actually coming to the dinner. I need to make the reservation. Can I have a show of hands of the 12 finalists? Can you give your name to the TA in the next 5 minutes so we can let Bill know how many people are coming? The second thing is, can you please write on a piece of paper, minutes of break. The last class, the last scheduled class, is of course the last day of classes. We have another time slot, which is not a Monday. Wednesday, June 14, something like this, minus one. So I want to know from you whether you want us to do something on that Wednesday, which is our time slot for the final, or whether there's no final in the class. We could talk about projects. I could tell you how some of these things are done really in practice. I want to know from you, I'm very happy to come on that Wednesday, who would be able to come on Wednesday sort of midday at the final time, so we got allocated by the school. And if you actually are able at all to come, what is it that, reflecting on what you've learned so far, you would actually like us to do that? So let's not do this in the precious break we have. I will send out an email via you to all the students describing the option, the time slot, and hear from you whether you want us to do something here and what it is that you want, what we want to do. We know about the impossibility of evaluation. I'll be a dictator and then deciding what to do. And what the only thing we need to do in the 5 minutes right now is that you need to know who is going to dinner. And just for 20 minutes, I'll tell you what I'll be doing. I'll be talking about social networks, how Mark Smith's work allows us, by looking at email hedging and market research, how to come up with ranking of email. I'll talk about dating sites, particularly where the dynamic revelation of information. I talked about LinkedIn a little bit. I talk about viral marketing. And I talk about some statistics on Wikipedia. So for each of these topics, we have about 3 minutes left. Okay, quick break, and we'll be back in 12 minutes, and then we have 15 minutes left.
What's up, Rebecca?
We'll be back in 5 minutes.